Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Last week on Research on Religion, we featured a light and upbeat look into music ministry and included both an original song and a traditional Christmas carol from our guest Ryan Habig. This week, we take a darker turn, specifically to the topic of dark networks, essentially secret societies that engage in nefarious behavior. Ever since the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001, scholars have become increasingly interested in understanding such underground societies. How do they organize? What allows them to stay hidden? And from a counterinsurgency perspective, how can they be disrupted and prevented from engaging in violent behavior? Admittedly, our topic will take us a bit astray from a direct examination of religion today, as these dark networks can operate with secular intent and can also exist separate from religious organizations. For example, the Baader-Meinhof gang in Germany during the 1970s, or narco-terrorist groups operating around the world today. However, in recent decades, there has been a growing connection between religious motivation and terrorist activity, most notably linked to variants of Islamic fundamentalism, with Al-Qaeda and the Taliban being the most recognized groups associated with this. In many respects, as noted on a past podcast with Ellie Berman, religious organizations offer a suitable breeding ground for dark networks, as they help to solve collective action problems, limit free riders, and help establish trusting relations between members, which is essential if you are a leader of a dark network and are worried about being infiltrated by your enemies. Our usual caveat needs to be mentioned here, that even though terrorist groups may have been increasingly associated with Islamic fundamentalism, not all Islamic fundamentalists are terrorists. Understanding how to separate out those two is of interest to many academics and policymakers so that better counterinsurgency strategy and tactics can be developed with the goal of saving innocent lives. And so, to investigate this topic, I have invited Professor Sean Everton, an assistant professor in the Department of Defense Analysis at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. Sean specializes in the study of network analysis and has authored several papers on networks, ranging from the Jesus Seminar of the 1970s to the Promise Keepers of the 1990s, and a recently co-authored article with Nancy Roberts entitled Strategies for Combating Dark Networks, that will be the central topic of today's discussion. I should also mention that Sean has led a very eventful life, having played professional baseball and served as a co-pastor with his wife at his congregation. He also shares a common achievement with the host of this program, having a black belt in Taekwondo. So be prepared for some intellectual sparring on the academic map today. And finally, Professor Everton maintains his own blog called God, Politics, and Baseball, which is filled with interesting thoughts and commentary, including some of his favorite Christmas songs and movies. We will link to his blog on our website, so please stop by and say hello. And while you're visiting the interwebs, don't forget to like us on Facebook, as we are trying to build our own network of listeners. Not a dark and nefarious one, but one filled with light and learning, and which is also free to the general public. Hey, Sean, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you very much. It's an honor to be included in the podcast.
Yes, I should note, too, that you are a frequent listener to our podcast, and that's kind of how we found you, which is kind of neat.
Yes, I have about an hour's commute into Monterey, and so I usually listen to the Research on Religion podcast of the week.
Oh,
man. One of my days going in.
So. See, that's awesome. Now all everybody has to do around the world is just commute to Monterey, and then they can listen to this.
That's right.
The one thing I forgot to mention about your biography, and you actually happen to be working on at the very moment that I called you, is a book manuscript that you're crafting. Is that correct?
That's correct. In fact, I was working on it this morning.
Uh-huh. Well, what's the working title and the theme of that book?
Right now, it's the working title is Disrupting Dark Networks, And the theme of it is to use the use of social network analysis to disrupt, actually to track, disrupt, monitor dark networks.
Mm-hmm. And that's going to be what we're talking about today. So you got a whole book's worth of knowledge up there in your cranium, and we're going to have to peel that out from you now. I do have another biographical note, and I mentioned that you're an assistant professor at the Naval Postgraduate School. And the Naval Postgraduate School is not your traditional undergraduate college with a football team. And so many of our listeners might not be all that familiar with this institution. Can you give us a little bit of background as to what the Naval Postgraduate School is?
Yeah, it's an accredited research university. And as you mentioned, it's located in Monterey, California. It's run by the U.S. Navy. Most of our students are active duty officers from all the branches of the military. So, like, most of my students, we can talk about my department here in a second, but in fact, most of my students tend to be from the Army rather than the other branches, because we have a lot of Special Forces students.
Well, it must have been wild the other weekend when Navy played Army.
Yeah, there was people walking around with Beat Army and Beat Navy buttons on their lapels.
Yeah.
The Army students are a little frustrated, I think.
Yeah, 10 years running. So go ahead. You got a lot of Special Forces guys. You got a lot of Navy guys. What else does the school cater to? Is it specifically a certain set of things that are studying, or is it a broad range of stuff at the Naval Postgraduate School?
In many ways, very much a traditional civilian university. I mean, it's run by the Navy, but it really takes traditional civilian topics and see how they can apply them to, things of interest to the military and Department of Defense, that sort of thing. We offer a wide range of master's degrees. We have engineering degrees, and we have even had some doctoral degrees. We got four graduate schools, a number of departments. I mean, we have a business school, we have a physics department, a meteorology department, a computer science department, information sciences. We have quite a wide array of opportunities. And like I said, most of our students are active duty officers, but we do have a few civilians who take classes. There's also a school located in Monterey called the Monterey Institute of International Studies, which is a graduate school, and a lot of those students, it's a graduate school of Middlebury College, and a lot of those students take classes at MPS as well.
Now, this mostly U.S. graduates, U.S. servicemen and women?
Mostly, although we do have a good cohort of international students. Especially in our department, there's a lot of international students come here to learn more things about or get better educated in terms of counterinsurgency and some of the things we specialize in our department.
Now, your department is called the Department of Defense Analysis. Is that kind of like a political science mixed with international relations and strategy type of department?
That's a pretty good description. We're a multidisciplinary department. Most of our faculty are political scientists, but we have some historians. We have a anthropologist. I'm the token sociologist.
Mm-hmm.
We even have a poet on staff.
No way! Are you serious?
We really do.
And he teaches poetry classes.
He teaches writing classes.
Oh, okay, all right.
He also has classes on ethics as well.
Okay. No offense to the poets out there. I mean, I'm sure it's a very important thing, but I can't see a bunch of jarheads taking poetry classes.
Well, he's a very popular professor. In fact, he was actually selected a few years back as the top teacher at the Naval Postgraduate School.
Yeah, very cool. How did you get hooked up there? Because you're a sociologist, and if I'm correct, you were trained down at Stanford and. You spent a little time at Santa Clara University. You're not a military guy, are you? You're a baseball player.
I'm a baseball player. No, I don't have a background in military. And most faculty at MPS are civilians. Some are former military, but we have a lot of us are just good old civilians. But I was finishing up my doctorate at Stanford, where I actually did my dissertation. It was related to social network analysis, but it was on the venture capital industry. And I was looking at the causes and consequences of success in the venture capital industry. And I was teaching at Santa Clara, and a professor at the Naval Postgraduate School, Nancy Roberts, she was starting a class on dark networks. This is the class I now teach, but she was starting a class on dark networks, and she was she wanted some instruction on how to learn this particular social network analysis software program called UCINET, which is sort of the granddaddy of social network analysis software packages. And so she sent an email out, a query. We didn't know each other, but somehow the email eventually reached me through, you know, 2 or 3 degrees of separation. And so I sent her an email, said, well, I'd be happy to come down and show you sort of the basics for a day. And so I went down and showed her, and that was about it at the time. And I went back working on my dissertation and teaching at Santa Clara. And I was on a year-to-year contract at Santa Clara at the time. And every spring, they always say, well, we can't guarantee whether we're going to bring you back the next year. And so I got the obligatory letter. And just about that time, I got a query from Nancy Roberts saying if I would be interested in coming to the Department of Defense Analysis as a postdoc for a year. And that seemed a little more stable than going on this year-to-year.
Yep,
and
yay jobs. Yeah,
a real job. And so I decided to do that after I finished my dissertation. So I spent a year as a postdoc. Initially, I was just supposed to write a manual that is serving as a basis for this book for the classes, for the class she was teaching. But then just by circumstance, I ended up almost immediately teaching the dark networks class, so I was there about a year, and then they advertised for a position for someone in who did social network analysis, and I applied, and I got the job, and now I have a tenure track position at the Naval Postgraduate School in the Department of Defense Analysis.
That's pretty cool. Now you kind of started off the traditional academic path, thought you'd be kind of an ivory tower guy. Have you been doing any policy consulting as a result of this? Did they fly you out to the Pentagon or something, or fly people from the Pentagon and talk to you?
Well, I don't do so much of that directly. However, I have been to the Pentagon a couple of times to brief. When we do a PowerPoint presentation, we call them briefs, although often they're not terribly brief.
Yeah.
I've been to the Pentagon a couple of times to brief on some of the things that we're doing at the Defense Analysis Department. And I'm also co-director of a lab, what we call the Core Lab, which is a Common Operational Research Environment Lab. And we sort of specialize in a particular set of analytical methods for gaining an understanding of, insurgent networks, dark networks.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been to the Pentagon a couple of times to brief people on what we've been doing. And then almost every week we have at least one person, sometimes we have 4 or 5, who visits MPS, and the Core Lab is becoming much more popular. And so it seems like every week we have someone coming through who wants to know what the Core Lab's doing. And so either myself or my co-director, Colonel Greg Wilson, will brief these people on what we're doing in the Core Lab. So we sort of have an indirect effect on policy and also through our students, because we talk a little bit about the policy. But a lot of our focus really is at the tactical level, because, these are, like I said, most of my students tend to be special forces. And so these are people who are trying to make decisions, on the ground. So less grand policy, at least what I do. We do have people in the department who focus more on that. But
okay.
Mia and Nancy Roberts and folks associated with the Core Lab, we tend to drill down more to the tactical level.
Well, let's go ahead and start getting to this issue about dark networks. But I have one more question for you, and that's because you have a black belt in Taekwondo. So I have to ask, you're dealing with all this counterinsurgency stuff. Are you a super secret ninja agent?
No, if I wasn't, I told you I'd have to kill you.
Yeah, see, that's exactly what a dark or a super secret ninja agent would say anyway, so I don't know. Okay.
My daughter, she goes, every once in a while, about every couple of months, she goes, no, Dad, I sometimes think you do something more.
That True Lies kind of stuff.
Yeah, I think you saw that movie with Schwarzenegger about True Lies.
Yeah. All right, so let's go ahead and get down to business now, and I know our audience is waiting to hear about these dark networks things. So first off, tell us, what is a dark network?
Well, we define dark networks as covert and illegal networks. That's a handy definition, although it isn't it doesn't quite capture it all because, you know, it sort of depends what your operating environment is, whether you, how covert you are. So, for instance, when Al-Qaeda was operating in Afghanistan and with the support of the Taliban, they didn't have to remain terribly covert. They had to remain covert from, say, the United States and other groups that were trying to track them down. But so they maybe clandestine might be another way of thinking about it. But it, you know, it's the best way to think of it is they're networks that are trying to remain hidden at least from somebody, and they're doing things that at least somebody doesn't like. Now, dark networks, you know, I tend to focus on what I call bad dark networks, but there have been good dark networks, too.
Well, give us some examples of that.
Well, like one group that I actually have interest in, I might end up doing a paper on them once I get my book done, is like in during World War II. Well, I should back up. During World War II, there was a group operating in Warsaw called Jakota, and I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correct. I've heard it pronounced a couple of ways. But they were a predominantly Roman Catholic organization that offered a number of services to the Jews in Warsaw during, you know, at the time of the Warsaw Ghetto and all this. And they were able to save a lot of lives. And one of their more interesting, ministries, one of their more interesting operations was the saving of Jewish babies. They went and convinced a lot of Jewish families who had Jewish families living in the Warsaw Ghetto to actually give up their babies so that they could be placed for adoption in various places, primarily Roman Catholic convents. And I read a statistic just recently about, or I was watching a documentary about the group, but they actually. They placed 2,500 Jewish babies with in Catholic Roman Catholic nunneries, convents, mm-hmm. And that when they were there, they were taught, you know, the Roman Catholic liturgy. So if people came to see, they'd be able to sound like Roman Catholics and that sort of thing. Interesting fact is, all 2,500 of those children survived World War II. And so anyway, that would be an example of what I would call a good dark network. But as far as the Nazis were concerned, they weren't.
Yeah.
And so they had to remain hidden.
Right. No, so we talked about, and I mentioned this at the beginning of the introduction, secular and religious dark networks. And are there any patterns that you've discerned about how these dark networks might operate, either between secular and religious ones? Are there certain common themes that if I wanted to start my own dark network, I'd have to follow these themes?
Well, dark networks, again, it sort of depends on the operating environment, but because they try to remain hidden, I'm developing a paper that's focusing just on religious dark networks, but a lot of what I write about would apply to secular dark networks as well, is that dark networks tend to recruit through what I call ties of trust, or what Mark Granovetter referred to as strong ties. And these are ties that, where you have repeated interaction with individuals, people who, and like I said, trust networks, people with whom you can trust. I mean, this is for security reasons. And so they tend to recruit through what I call these trust networks. And because of that, they tend to form very dense networks. And so, for instance, say you and I were really good friends, and I recruited you into my dark network. And because we were strong friends, we had repeated interactions with one another. But I'd have other strong ties within the network as well, with people who would have repeated interaction. Chances are, over time, you would form ties with all of my other strong ties. So this has a tendency to make the network very dense, where everybody knows everybody else. What that can lead to is what Cass Sunstein, who used to teach at the University of Chicago law school, I think he's currently with the Obama administration, but he's very interested in studying juries and how juries can move to what he calls extreme positions But he noted that when you get a bunch of like-minded individuals together, there's the tendency, what he calls the law of group polarization, there's a tendency for the group's collective opinion to gravitate to the opinion of the most extreme opinion within the group. So for instance, let's see, like one of his examples here, he talks about, say you have an academic department, say at the beginning of the Iraq War. Say most people get engaging in the conversation, decide to get together to talk about what they think about the Iraq War and what they should do about it. He would argue that if they came together to debate, you know, ways of protesting the war, there would be the tendency for the group as a whole to gravitate to a very extreme position. Or taking a jury, for instance. Say you have a product liability trial, and 9 jurors believe the manufacturer is somewhat guilty, and 3 believe it's entirely guilty. The 3 will draw the other 9 toward a larger award than the 9 would have allowed on by themselves. So this is what happens when you have these really dense, dark networks. And to bring it back to the terrorist discussion, Mark Sageman did a study of what he calls the global Salafi jihad, which includes the individuals who flew the planes into the Twin Towers and the Pentagon. He found that the people who joined the global Salafi jihad tended to be homesick young men who had often a long way away from home because they left home and come to, say, Germany to work. So they tend to be homesick. They'd drift to familiar settings. In this case, it would be the mosque, where they'd look for companionship. Then they, small clusters of friends would form, and then they'd move into apartments together where they would undergo long periods of intense social interaction, and the group as a whole would actually progressively adopt the beliefs of the group's more extreme members. And he found this to be true of the Hamburg cell. They actually had microphones in there that were monitoring what was going on, and they did nothing about it. But and then eventually they were linked into the global Salafi jihad and participated in 9/11. So you have this tendency for groups, because they tend to recruit these strong ties, to be very dense networks, and this can lead. It's not inevitable. People are not automatons, but it tends to lead to extreme behavior. The other thing is that these dark networks tend to limit ties to outsiders for obvious reasons, security reasons. They have to have some ties so they can have access to important information, but they try to keep those to a minimum. And this, again, these outside ties can act as countervailing forces if you have enough of them, so people can hear other people's views. And this would also put a check on, say, some of these extreme behavior. But because they limit these ties, it tends to contribute to the likelihood that you'll drift to this more extreme behavior.
Now, we're showing religion, and as you're talking about this, I can't help but think about religion, and people invested in a theology can oftentimes slide toward a more radical theology. And you've looked at some not so dark religious networks, or not ones that are trying to remain hidden. Your example that I gave earlier was the Jesus Seminar. Have you learned anything, or what have we as scholars learned about religious networks that gives us insight into some of these more nefarious versions of these secret societies?
Well, I think in that case, I think the work of Larry Yannacone and Ellie Berman fit in quite nicely here. And I know Ellie's been on before,
mm-hmm.
And Ellie and I have chatted on occasion as well. And this whole notion of strictness that, you know, Larry Yannacone really talked about in his early work in the 1990s, you know, strict churches are strong, sacrifice and stigma. I think this can actually contribute to the density of networks, and also to the limiting of external ties. Right, because strictness, Larry's strictness argument is that, you know, there's this expectation. For instance, if you're just talking about a strict church, there's this expectation you will attend church every week.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't, you will usually get a phone call, see if you're okay. And also that you will associate primarily with people within the church. I can remember when I was attending a Baptist church several years ago, and you know, I was in a college career group, and we were a pretty close group, and there was one girl in the group who started dating someone outside of the church. In fact, he was a Roman Catholic.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, yes, and it was just horrors. We just thought the world had come to an end.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you sort of had this tendency to limit outside connections and also to encourage internal connections. And again, this I think contributes to this density factor. It might be an additive factor that you may not get in secular groups.
Yeah. One of the things that Iannacone and then Berman write about is how these very strong, dense networks or these strict churches actually solve a lot of free rider problems, right? Anybody who doesn't want to buy into, you know, having phone calls or not dating this person or that person is not going to get in there. And so what happens is you get this huge clump of individuals who have very strong views on something and that they function very well. They're really good at organizing collective action. And, you know, Berman has taken this to show that, you know, solving a terrorist plot is really a collective action problem. How do you get, you know, 5, 6, 10, 12 people to cooperate to accomplish this? And, you know, these small religious communities, very strict religious communities, help to do that. But what you're saying here is something interesting that creates these dense networks. And you come back to this idea of network theory. And I want to stop and take a look at that because a lot of our listeners probably don't know much about it. This is something that was relatively new when I was first starting out as a professor and everyone's walking around talking about, oh, network theory, network theory. Give us an idea what network theory is.
Okay. So network theory, it's probably better to think of it as more of a collection of theories and methods rather than just a single coherent theory. But it does the various theories and methods operate under the assumption that the behavior of actors, whether we're talking about individuals or groups or organization, is profoundly affected by their ties to others and the networks in which they are embedded. Right. So rather than viewing individuals as or actors as just sort of operating based on their unaffected by their surroundings. Network theory assumes that the surrounding environment has a profound impact on what they choose to believe, say, do, and so on and so forth. And so network theory is a, like I said, a collection of methods and theories that tries to capture this environment. And we do this looking at ties between various actors. There can be friendship ties, can be business ties, can be kinship ties. There's a lot of threads that have fed into network theory. And sort of the traditional story is that it really developed, you can trace it back to some of the early social scientists, and then there are some social scientists in the 20th century who started mapping social networks, looking at friendship ties and affection ties. Jacob Marino was one of the first to do that. And then it really developed took off in the 1960s at Harvard with a guy named Harrison White and a number of his students who were trying to look at a way for empirically sort of capturing what, you know, we social scientists talk about as, refer to as social structure. We always talk about social structure, but often it's kind of this nebulous thing.
Yeah, we never know what it is.
Right. And Harrison White and his students were trying to get at a way of trying to actually empirically capture this notion of social structure, and they looked for these social networks as a way of doing this. And so it sort of grew up around there, around a lot of his stuff. But, I mean, that's, of course, a simplified story. There's much more to it than that.
Well, one of the things that I should note, you know, I mentioned that a lot of this was getting going when I was a young professor. Now, I wasn't around as a professor in the 60s. I was around, but not as a professor. I should make that clear. But it really kind of takes off in the 90s. And one of the things you mentioned, we talked about mapping. And this is one thing that network analysis people do. And I see you do this in your work and papers. You love to draw little nodes and lines connecting them. And yeah, you talked about threads connecting different individuals. And it really reveals how densely packed a network can be versus loosely packed. You can take a look at some of these graphs that you draw, and there'll just be a path of really, really thick, dark lines connecting a very few small amount of nodes, as compared to something that looks like a giant spider web hung between two trees that you could actually poke your fingers through. So that's the kind of stuff you're doing, right?
Right. That's a pretty good description.
Yeah. All right. So let's kind of talk about some of this network theory and related to dark networks. You know, I'm thinking about how to do this. If you had to map people, and again, I guess the network theory too, it reminds me of that Kevin Bacon game. How many degrees of separation are you from Kevin Bacon? I think some people started playing that in the 1980s or so when he was still popular. But Kevin Bacon's kind of easy because he's all around the place. But studying dark networks really has to be difficult to do because you're dealing with research subjects that do not want to be found. And I'm just thinking about my own work with graduate students. I get a lot of starry-eyed graduate students who think they can write the definitive work on political corruption or drug gangs. And they say, I'm just going to go out to the field and ask these participants in these groups what they're up to. And I'm seriously, people do this. And I have to remind them that's not going to be easy. One, because people are probably going to lie to you if they're dealing with corruption because they don't know who you are. And number two, it can be really deadly. Right, you don't just go into a narco-terrorist group and saying, hi, what are you up to? I'm studying you and like to publish this paper, because, you know, they're not going to take too kindly to that. So how do you guys deal with understanding network theory for dark, secretive networks?
That's a really good question, because collecting the data can be very, very difficult. So in the class I teach, we actually use an article that was written by the International Crisis Group about a terrorist network out of Indonesia called the Norrentop Terrorist Network. Norrentop was participated in, he was part of Jamaah Islamiyah, but I almost referred to it as JI. I picked up the bad habit of using a lot of acronyms. So one of the things I should back up a little bit, because the students that I teach include both international students and U.S. students, we need to keep the class itself unclassified, so they have to use open source data. And so we let them get practice collecting these data or recording these data using an unclassified document so they know the right way to do it, so to speak. But then when they, you know, after they leave, then they're often faced with what you just raised, the difficulty of actually getting good data. And we always have to be wary of the fact that the data we're looking at may not be complete. And what we stress is that social network analysis, when you're working with potentially incomplete data and you're trying to map these networks, you should use social network analysis as a tool for crafting strategies but not making final decisions. Because, you know, you can say, okay, here's three ways that we might want to disrupt this particular dark network, but you just don't want to stop there. You want to consult other forms of intelligence or other types of intelligence to make sure that this, what you found, actually does make sense. I remember I was some time ago, I went back and visited the IED facility, the counter IED facility back in Washington D.C., where they studied a lot of, you know, trying to disrupt the IED networks in Iraq.
Now, the IED, that's the improvised explosive device, right?
Thank you. See, I slipped into my...
Yeah, well, you're at one of these military schools now, so, you know.
I slipped into my acronym right there, and I didn't even know it. Yes, and so I talked to one of the network analysis persons, and she showed me this study that she had done, where she was using some little matrix multiplication. She identified a city that appeared to be a very important supply hub for some of these IED networks.
Mm-hmm.
And so she sort of shot it back to the powers that be, but before they did anything with it, before they make any decisions, she also made sure it went to the ethnographers and other experts to see, does this actually make sense? And so they did some additional research, and they found... yes, it does make sense. And so they actually decided to pursue some strategies that could target this particular city or for disrupting the flow of supplies coming out of that city.
Mm-hmm.
I have some students right now who are very aware of this problem, and again, it has to do with IEDs. And they're intelligence operators, and they're looking at ways, well, how can we disrupt these IED networks? And so they realize that, you know, there's, you know, while people may like you, the devices themselves tend not to. Mm-hmm. And so they've developed this method for capturing, a method for capturing information on every IED device that is found, whether it's exploded or unexploded. And then based on the components that are included within the bomb, they will either infer or not infer ties between them. And the idea is here is that a bomb maker tends to leave a signature in the way they make a bomb. They may not make them identical, but they tend to be a lot of similarities. So you can run these, you can collect data on all these IEDs with the associated components, and then run some similarity correlations, and then put a threshold and say, okay, if you get a similarity, let's say a level of say 50% or 60%, we're going to say that there's a tie between those two IEDs. And then when you do this, you start seeing this clustering of IEDs in different areas, and they're also capturing this geospatially, right? And so they can say, oh wow, we have a cluster here, and it looks like it's located in this particular area, let's say Iraq or Afghanistan, and that allows them to be much more targeted in their use of resources. Because, you know, you might think, oh, well, you know, this guy's somewhere in this 100 square mile radius or what have you. But here you can maybe narrow it down to, say, 3 or 5 miles.
And I want to read a quote from your paper or your article with Nancy Roberts, because as you talk about this, it really resonated in my head. And here I quote it directly. Quote, as former director of the Defense Intelligence Agency, Lieutenant General Samuel V. Wilson put it, as cited in Flynn, 90% of intelligence comes from open sources. The other 10%, the clandestine work, is just the more dramatic. The real intelligence hero is Sherlock Holmes, not James Bond. Consequently, analysts needed to embrace open source, population-centric information as the lifeblood of their analytical work. And that's unquote. And as you're saying this, you're talking about IEDs and, you know, network analysis. I started thinking about human beings, but, you know, you're also talking about tracing the components. Oh, this kind of came from this supplier or this bomb. And then, you know, this particular bomb maker puts the switch on this side or uses this particular cell phone to operate things. And that's the kind of information that you're talking about, this open source information, right?
Yeah. But we also have, a tremendous amount of open source information just on various groups. I had a couple of students, and this wasn't a network analysis piece, but they had geospatial. They were looking at the FARC in Colombia.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't think of what their Spanish name is.
Yeah, it's a revolutionary group that tends to occupy a significant amount of territory down in southeast Colombia, I believe.
That is correct.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were. They had open source information on FARC camps both in Colombia and also in Venezuela.
Mm-hmm.
And then using their knowledge of supply routes, they were able to hypothesize the location of other FARC camps both in Colombia and in Venezuela. And so the student who worked on this gentleman named Carlos Major Padilla, he's teamed up with one of our U.S. students, Major Doug Zimmerman, and they, when Major Padilla went back to Colombia for Christmas break, he showed their analysis to his superior, and they matched it up with some of their intelligence resources, and they found that these guys were right. Mm-hmm. But there had to be a FARC camp in these particular areas within Venezuela. This actually led to an international incident of all things, because the Colombian ambassador went to the meeting of the Organization of American States and accused the Venezuelan government of harboring the FARC, because the Colombian special forces were cracking down, and so they were finding safe havens over in Venezuela, and Venezuela was saying, okay, we support your efforts. And so anyway, this led to this international incident. But it's a really good example of how you can really use open source data to infer good, to deduce very good intelligence information, or I don't know if I phrase that eloquently.
Is this kind of like the NCIS or CSI television shows where, you know, you're tracking credit card receipts and where this person happened to visit and the apartment they live in next to somebody else? You start drawing all these lines and you have a big, huge computer screen in front of you. It's usually pretty cool and modern looking. I know that Army facilities are not always that great. Navy's probably a little bit better, but you know, you're tracking all these things and the lines are crossing, and eventually there's one node that pops up, flashes. They say, ah, that must be the base camp, or, you know, these people are connected to these other five people we hadn't seen before. Is it something like that going on?
There is some of that going on. There's some very, and I don't watch CSI on a regular basis, so I haven't seen what software they're using, but there is some very sophisticated software out there for collecting that type of data, where you can draw lines between people and cars and other people and have their geospatial locations. And and then you can draw some inferences just from that analysis itself. And then if you want to do more deep dives, most of these data are geospatially coded, so you can take it into some of the dedicated geospatial programs. And if you want to do some deep dives in terms of social network analysis, you can take it into the more dedicated social network analysis programs as well.
Wow. Yeah, that's kind of fun. I bet you have a really cool computer. Do you have a really big computer screen?
Actually, I don't, but on the Core Lab, we have some really nice ones. I tend to operate off my laptop.
Oh, okay. You're one of those guys like in the field carrying stuff with their laptops. And okay, that's pretty cool. So, yeah, the only reason I say that, because at work, I have this little tiny computer screen, and I got it, you know, 10 years ago when flat screens were really cool, and everybody's like, oh, wow. But now everybody's got these big, you know, 52-inch plasma things.
Those are very nice. I don't work with one myself, but we do have a few around, so they're very nice.
Very cool. Let's go ahead and talk about your paper with Nancy Roberts, which is published in the public record. So we are going public with this. No, we're not revealing any super secret ninja spy stuff here. It's in a journal called the Journal of Social Structure, and it's about disrupting these dark networks. So before telling us about your findings, could you give us an idea about how past policymakers, maybe even going back to World War II or further than that, how they've addressed this issue of infiltrating and breaking up dark networks or spy networks or anything like that?
Well, I think, you know, the paper itself captures the very strategies that we have used over the years. And I don't know if you want to talk about those strategies right now.
Yeah, let's go ahead. I mean, by saying we, are you talking the U.S. government or?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Not just you and your secret life as a True Lies Schwarzenegger guy. Yeah.
Yeah, no.
Okay.
No, I'm talking about we and the much more generalized we. So, you know, there's strategies where you sort of target key individuals. And let me back up a little bit. One of the motivations behind the paper that Nancy and I wrote was that when people have used social network analysis, there has been a tendency, not everybody does this, but there had been a tendency for people to identify central players within the network. And we have a number of different metrics for identifying who's central. Adopting what they call the whack-a-mole strategy, just, you know, try to take a central player out, assuming that if you take a central player out, this will disrupt the network. And sometimes it does.
Yeah, I'm thinking about the Sendero Luminoso. Once they got Guzman, I forget his first name, he was the leader of this, I guess, dark network in Peru during the 1960s and 70s. And once they whacked that mole, and I love the term whack-a-mole, by the way, because it happens to be one that I used in my most recent book. Once they got that, the whole network just fell apart. So that is kind of the old strategy, just find the main dude, the big node at the center point with lots of lines coming to him, and get rid of that point?
Yeah, I mean, that's one strategy that people have adopted, and it's very intuitive, and it grabs headlines, too. Right, you know, when, you know, Osama bin Laden was, you know, killed, you know, back in the spring, you know, that, you know, obviously he was a big guy, but it did attract a lot of attention. And so that it tends to be something that people gravitate to. But there's a number of different strategies that people have used or that we have used over the years that have been very effective, especially with counterinsurgency. Going after the most central person is not always the best idea. You can, sometimes it works, but sometimes it can develop a lot of backlash. Sometimes if you're dealing with a very decentralized network, removing a central node may have little or no effect. You know, the FARC, going back to the FARC, it's a really good example of a group that's has lost their top leaders over the years, but they just keep right on going. They've been around for 40 years. And so sometimes networks can be very resilient to these types of strategies. And so there's different ways of trying to get at these networks. And so we look at targeting, which I was just talking about, the whack-a-mole, and that can either be used either by, if you know, in my paper, we sort of write from a U.S. perspective. That can be either from the U.S. Special Forces or doing it, or helping indigenous forces do the same sort of thing.
Now, in that paper, you have two major approaches. One is called kinetic approach. Right. The other is non-kinetic. And so you talked about the whack-a-mole or the targeting strategy as being a kinetic approach. What do you mean by kinetic?
Kinetic is basically, you know, kinetic is this, it's the term that, and I didn't know it before I started working at MPS, but kinetic strategies are coercive strategies. Essentially, tends to use violence or coercive measures to disrupt insurgencies or dark networks. Non-kinetic tends to gravitate towards, I don't know if non-violent is the right word, but to non-coercive strategies. You know, the kinetic could see it as a bombs and bullets approach. The non-kinetic might be seen more as the hearts and minds approach or something like that.
So let's start with that kinetic approach. And within the kinetic approach, you talked about two separate tactics, I would guess, the kinetic approach being the strategy, perhaps these other things are the tactics. One you say is the targeting, the whack-a-mole, find the big node, get rid of that, and all the other lines disappear and scoot off into the netherworld. The other thing that you put under kinetic approach is something called capacity building. Now, what is that?
That's essentially the same thing, except here it's not, you know, so we wrote this paper more from a U.S. perspective. In this case, it'd be helping other forces, indigenous forces, carry out basically the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So like a number of our special forces were deployed to the Philippines early 2000s, and they could not operate themselves, but they were deployed in order to train Philippine forces on how they could fight insurgent groups such as the Abu Sayyaf group or the Moro Islamic Liberation Front. So they're very similar. Just one is whether it's the host nation or whether it's more as a consulting approach, so to speak.
Okay, so it's just targeting, but you're training other people to target
right
through the targeting. So let's move on to the more interesting approach, non-kinetic approach. I think most people get the kinetic thing, right?
Yeah.
You get the bad guys, you put them in the crosshairs, you take care of it. The non-kinetic approach, now that's a little bit different, and you have four different sub-strategies or tactics you call institution building, psychological operations, information operations, and rehabilitation. So let's just go down that list. And non-kinetic, it's going to be less coercive, hearts and minds type of strategy. What do you mean by institution building?
This would be like building up the infrastructure of a particular country. So for instance, in this paper with Nancy Roberts and myself, one of our illustrative examples is that we analyze what we call the trust network of this particular network. We're looking at this Northern Top terrorist network out of Indonesia. And we notice over the course of this analysis that school ties tend to be quite central to Norden's network. And so we move up a level from the individuals and look at the network of schools, and we discover that there's two or three schools that are quite central to Norden's network in terms of recruiting, you know, getting new people and the training and that sort of thing. And so one approach would be the kinetic approach, shut the school down.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. A non-kinetic approach is what we call the three cups of tea approach, was that you build an alternative school that give parents alternatives to where they could send their kids to school. And the idea here is to, you know, so they learn, get more moderate types of training, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Are there attempts to possibly reform those other schools, get different faculty members in there or something?
Well, it's kind of hard sometimes because the ones we mentioned in the paper are actually run by JI. And so,
what JI is?
Oh, Jamaat Islamiyah.
Okay.
Yeah, so they probably would not be interested in reforming. And then,
yeah, I guess that sits with the whole dense network thing, that if you do want to reform people, you just can't walk in there saying, hi, I'm your reformer, can I be your friend? And everybody embraces you. They probably push you out the front door.
Yeah, so here's this, you know, trying to provide alternatives, alternative paths that people can take in terms of getting their education.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously this is a long-term strategy. It's not going to change things overnight. Psychological operations.
Yeah, PSYOPs. Everybody hears about PSYOPs and the, you know, adventure films and stuff. So what's all this psychological operations stuff?
It includes a lot of different different approaches, but it looks at ways of say sowing seeds of dissatisfaction within the network, getting people not to trust one another, perhaps. In fact, one of our former students employed this successfully after he graduated from MPS. He was deployed out to northern Iraq, and he had some intelligence on a particular insurgent network. And they initially did actually try to run a kinetic operation on the group. After he ran a social network analysis of the group, they identified some key leaders. They ran a kinetic operation. And it was unsuccessful. The network was very resilient, and it just kept on going. And so they decided to run a deception operation, a misinformation operation, where they wanted to get the people within the group to stop trusting one another.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they couldn't actually get into the network themselves, and they couldn't have direct contact with these central nodes. But they did know people within the wider community that had connections to these individuals. And so they actually fed misinformation to these community members, hoping that it would find its way back into the network. And it did. And the network, everybody stopped trusting one another, and the network imploded within a couple of months.
Yeah, I could see how that works, thinking about all the mapping that you do with the lines and the nodes. Is you find a node that is out on the periphery somewhere, and you inject it with, you know, some green goo that you hope is going to spread throughout those networks, and it gets into the, I guess, the main veins, I would, so to speak, to some of the main individuals.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's kind of cool. I like that's a kind of a fascinating one way to break that up. And you mentioned that's successful in northern Iraq. Does that tend to be successful in other places? Is that one of the dominant strategies? Or
Well, I don't know if it was a dominant strategy beforehand, but then the gentleman who ran this operation, he sort of became the local, the SNA guru in Iraq for a while. He came back after his tour, actually lectured some of our classes and in some of our classes about how he had done this. And then he was redeployed back to Iraq to
do it all over again, huh?
Yeah, well, actually, he went back and was analyzing light networks, quasi-light networks, but they were interested in corruption, that sort of thing. So maybe it was a gray network.
Yeah, okay.
But yeah, we tried to, you know, that's, again, going back to one of the purposes of this, the article was that, yeah, you know, the whack-a-mole strategy is very intuitive. It's what people gravitate to, but we were really trying to stress that there's lots of ways using social network analysis to disrupt these networks that actually might have more lasting effects.
Yeah.
Building schools, that sort of thing.
Yeah, because if you do the targeting thing, you get one guy and possibly everything could coalesce, kind of like how mercury comes back and forms a big blob once again. You can split it up really quick and doesn't look like much, but eventually it comes back.
Right.
Yeah. What, you had two more in this non-kinetic approach. Information operations, is that similar to psychological operations?
That's a good question. When we were writing this article, we were trying to identify the different strategies. Sometimes, and people have different definitions for these things. You know, we sent this paper out to different people, and somebody says, "Oh, you haven't defined information operations correctly. It's really part of PSYOP," and blah 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 blah. But we broke it out this way, and some people agree with it. Where are we really focusing more on electronic warfare, computer network operations, you know, looking at ways of saying disrupting fund transfers, if you're looking at the financial network of a particular dark network,
mm-hmm.
you know, maybe monitoring charitable donations, see if you can uncover money laundering, all these different approaches that use, you know, the digital transfer of information.
Yeah.
That sort of thing. So, yeah, sometimes IO, information operations, gets lumped together with PsyOps, but we wanted to break them out separately because we thought they were two distinct approaches.
Yeah, it's a different thing. You just kind of break the chain of information for informational operations rather than injecting some bit of misinformation.
Right.
What about that last one, rehabilitation? What does that mean? It sounds like you're going to go out to the beach and, you know, recover, dry out from alcoholism or something. What's going on there?
Well, interesting. When Nancy Roberts taught the first couple of iterations of the Dark Networks class, the way she set it up, and I followed this, is that after you do your analysis of the dark network, then give me three strategies for how you might disrupt it. So we sort of forced the students to try to think in a number of different ways. What she noticed was is that a lot of the international students, especially coming from, say, like some of the Islamic countries, like Indonesia or what have you, tended to really push this notion of rehabilitation. You know, the U.S. students were much more likely to gravitate, say, to a kinetic approach, whereas some of the Islamic students were going, well, you know, we kind of like this rehabilitation approach. And so it got us to thinking that this is a genuine strategy, and there's been a number of rehabilitation programs, amnesty programs, in Saudi Arabia, in Singapore, Yemen, Indonesia, that are really trying to I guess what you might call engage in ideological reorientation.
Yeah, I heard about this in Yemen a couple years ago, that there was a school or a rehab clinic, and I know a lot of people kind of snickered at that in the news as well. You send an Al-Qaeda terrorist to, you know, rehab, you watch a few videos, you get a chip for every, you know, 3 days you don't blow up something. It sounds kind of ridiculous. How has that been successful?
They have met with some success. I haven't seen any really hard data. In fact, that's one of the things that Nancy and I have talked about, trying to get some really hard data on it. But reports come out of Singapore, they've had a very high level of success. Now, I would be willing to bet, and this actually ties back to one of your previous podcasts with Byron Johnson, when he was talking about more God, less crime, and recidivism, and when people would leave prisons. And he talked a lot about the importance of, once someone leaves prison, of getting them embedded in a new network of people who supported their change of heart, so to speak.
Yeah, the aftercare programs became very important, because you can change somebody in prison, but then you send them back out into the bad neighborhoods of Houston, and oh boy, that's going to cause, you know, they're just going to slip back into their previous ways because they don't have any role models or accountability partners.
Exactly, and so that's what I'm thinking about. That's why I'd like to get some hard data, see if what he found in his analysis holds true in some of these rehabilitation programs. I think they need what he calls an aftercare program. Is that, okay, so you get these people who do say, okay, they renounce their violent past and they're not going to do it anymore. My gut feeling is that if they go back to their old neighborhoods where they were initially recruited, there's a really good chance that they will revert. They will not, their conversion or their ideological reorientation will not stick. Mm-hmm. But if they're embedded in networks of support that, you know, encourage them in this new way of life, so to speak, then I think it might stick.
I'm just want to speculate here, now that you mentioned Byron Johnson's podcast, and we'll put a link up to that so people can track back to that. The importance of religious networks. Now, we noted earlier on in this that religious networks are oftentimes a very fertile ground for establishing some of these dark networks, because it builds these connections of trust. But now you think about rehabilitation, and you know, what Byron was talking about was faith-based prison ministries that, you know, really try to reorient somebody's way of thinking, their previous patterns and you need a sharp break with the past. I'm wondering to what extent religious groups could actually enhance this. If, you know, you got a very radical Islamic fundamentalist group that it's encouraging some types of this terrorist behavior, you know, is it possible to connect them up with different religious groups, different mosques or imams or networks like that? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, that's essentially what they're trying to do. Because, you know, it's interesting, Mark Sageman, when he did his study of the global Salafi jihad, he found that most of the people who were involved in the jihad actually came from secular backgrounds. They didn't go to religious schools. They went to secular schools. A lot of them tend not to convert until they were much older. And so a lot of them may not be, you know, I was thinking of your street preacher the other day. He was talking about when he first started preaching, you know, he didn't have a whole lot of theological depth, but eventually he formed it over time as he started refining his ministry. I think you could see a lot of it going on here as well. Is that there may not be, you know, since a lot of these guys are recent converts, there may not be a whole lot of theological depth going on there. And so they would be possibly open to consultations with more moderate imams and attendants at different mosques and that sort of thing.
Yeah. Well, let me go ahead and just about out of time here. And I want you to conclude and think about what you've been learning on this over the past several years, your use of network analysis, looking at these different strategies. What's your assessment of how, over the past 10 years, the U.S. government has done in disrupting a lot of these terrorist networks? Have we been fairly successful on it? Have we learned a lot? Are things changing? And what do you see about the future?
Ooh, well, that's a tough one.
I asked the tough questions on Research on Religion. So
yeah, it's we've had some successes. I mentioned a lot of them don't get a lot of headlines, of course. I mean, you know, the Bin Laden, of course.
Yeah, the kinetic targeting approach, taking them out. Yeah,
those tend to get a lot of headlines. But you know, just like the example of what one of our former students did in Iraq with the insurgency, just with this nice little PSYOP information. Misinformation campaign. You don't hear about that too much, but there have been a number of those going on that have been successful. Sometimes the whack-a-mole approach has not been successful. So we've been learning a lot about what works, what doesn't, and the importance of some of these alternative strategies in building these networks, maybe not in building these networks, in tearing down these networks. I was thinking of the Norton Top Terrorist Network. He was actually killed by Indonesian authorities in 2009, and the network, in many ways, sort of fell apart after that. I mean, some of the folks have been trying to sort of reconstitute themselves, but his particular organization seems to have sort of collapsed when he was removed from the network. But what's interesting is that I've mapped one of my colleagues in the core lab. He and I just recently mapped the Norton Top Terrorist Network over 10 years, from 2001 to 2010. And what was very interesting is that over time the network became increasingly centralized. Mm. And there's a lot of research that suggests that as highly centralized networks are actually pretty vulnerable to the removal of a key leader.
Yeah, the targeting kinetic approach.
Yeah. And removal, you know, when I say removal, you know, ideally most of us, I think even most of your special forces would actually prefer actually capturing over kinetic, because I think, it's Ellie Berman in his book, he points out the importance, you know, how when you capture someone, it really can disrupt the network because they have to change their... They don't know what kind of information is going to be given up, so they have to change all these different things. So capturing is always preferable over a pure kinetic approach. Going back to Norton, you know, we found that it became increasingly centralized over time, which made it very vulnerable to his removal. But what's interesting though is that if you just focused on the end state of what happened with Norton instead of go, wow, here's an example where whack-a-mole worked. Well, yeah, kind of. But there's also about 7 years worth of strategy undertaken by the Indonesian authorities with help from Australia, counterinsurgents, that they adopted different strategies that pushed Norton's network to become more centralized,
yeah,
which made it more vulnerable.
And one can see how these different approaches actually can, they're not separate approaches, but they can coordinate with one another or be complementary.
Right. Yeah. Right. So you can have first, second, third order effects. And so this is, again, it's really important to think about this wide array of strategies mm-hmm. rather than just focusing in on one.
Yeah. Well, that is probably a good place to conclude on. You are writing a book manuscript on this, and when it's all finished and out there on bookshelves, we'll be sure that we stop back and check in. And for folks that are listening, you should also, if you want to continue on and finding out some of Sean's weekly thoughts, you can check his God, Politics, and Baseball website. And I just got to ask you a few questions that are related to God, Politics, and Baseball. Now that Albert Pujols is over with the Anaheim Angels, should I just forget about the Seattle Mariners ever winning a World Series in the next 5-10 years?
Oh, I don't know. I was very disappointed when he took that. I was really hoping he was going to stay with the Cardinals, even though I'm a Giants fan.
Oh, you're a Giants fan, okay.
But even though I'm a Giants fan, I was really hoping he was going to stay with the Cardinals his whole career, at least most of his career. It just doesn't seem we have the loyalty anymore.
They lose those dense networks. They're all light now. You should do a network analysis of baseball and how that affects World Series titles and stuff.
Yeah, that might be something. That might be a might be a little more uplifting, huh?
It might be. Well, anyways, Sean, we appreciate your insights onto this very important topic, and I thank you for being on Research on Religion.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's an honor.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.